This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, a public service of Charlottesville Public Media. Are electronic voting machines vulnerable to computer hackers? That's the topic of the January Charlottesville Albemarle Democratic Breakfast. A panel of speakers discuss serious software issues, as well as recent controversies in Florida's 13th Congressional House District. The event is introduced by Russ Linden, the chair of the Albemarle County Democratic Party.
Even though this is sponsored by the City and County Democrats, everyone is welcome. And certainly for a topic like this on electronic voting machines, this may not be the kind of sexiest, jazziest topic to get people's attention around the country until you start thinking about the numbers of people who worry that their vote wasn't counted. And indeed, there's still one election from this past fall in Florida where it's been disputed because how many votes were there that were 18,000 votes that counted for certain issues on the ballot but weren't registered for the choice of representatives. So when you think about elections being won or lost literally in terms of is the process working right, this is something that affects all of us. So we're going to have a terrific discussion. I'll introduce our moderator who will introduce the panel in just a second. Okay, so as we said, our topic today is electronic voting machines. I happen to be a wonderful fan, a huge fan of the system that's used, I think, in Oregon where you cannot vote except by mail. And every time I read an article about it, it says that there's essentially no fraud, that voting participation is up among all age groups. They've had no problems. But we're not going to talk about that system today. We're going to look at the electronic systems and what are the strengths and possible weaknesses. And we have a terrific panel and the best person imaginable to lead the discussion or to moderate the discussion. His name is Jim Heilman, and he's going to introduce the panel in a second. Jim used to be the voter registrar in Albemarle County. We have several voter registrars and assistant registrars here today. Jim, for years, was the voter registrar in Albemarle County, and after he retired, quote unquote, he started to consult with other countries around the world that are developing their own democratic systems for voting, and I think he said at last count he's actually consulted in 15 such countries, including countries in the former Soviet Union. So it should be a terrific discussion. Thanks for being here, Jim.
Thank you. I think we're going to have a very interesting discussion here and very topical. Except for us election junkies and professionals, the ins and outs of voting machines were hardly a blip on the public's radar until Florida in 2000. Now everybody seems to have an opinion about voting machines and particularly electronic voting machines. In fact, as of Wednesday, there were no fewer than 7 bills in the General Assembly dealing with electronic voting, and there are several pending in Congress. I hope in this discussion we'll cover a lot of different aspects of electronic voting machines, what's good about them and what's bad about them, and of course we'll talk about paper receipts that show how you voted, but I don't want that topic to hog the whole conversation. I know we're going to get into it, but there are other aspects that I hope we are covering. And I will say that the press release that went out about this, the very first thing mentioned was that we would tackle serious issues of software. Well, other than one panelist and maybe a couple people in the audience, none of us are software experts, so we really don't want to get into the heavy-duty parts of software. We're also going to try to avoid acronyms, but there are two that I will mention right now because it's hard to get into a real conversation without mentioning them. The first one is DRE, and DRE means Direct Recording Electronic, and that's what most of our electronic voting machines are all about. The second one is VVPT or VVPAT, often called VPAT, which stands for Voter Verified Paper Audit Trail. So you might hear those terms. We'll try to avoid other ones. I'm going to introduce our panelists and then make a few brief remarks about the history of voting machines. To the far left, maybe in more ways than one, is Will Harvey. And Will is the Director of Business Development and Publishing for the American Health Lawyers Association. He's a graduate of both UVA and the University of Richmond T.C. Williams School of Law. He was a longtime chair of the Albemarle Democratic Committee, and upon retirement from that position, he became secretary in 2003 of the County Electoral Board, a position he still holds. On the right here is Rick Sincere, who was the Republican appointee as chair of the City Electoral Board in 2004 and 2005, and he now serves as its secretary. For those of you that don't understand, electoral board secretary is kind of the big position. They get paid twice as much as the other members. So. And Rick has testified before several General Assembly committees on the question of voting technology. His articles on that subject have appeared in The Hook and elsewhere. He is a blogger. Did you know that Microsoft doesn't recognize the word blogger as being a valid word? I just discovered that. He's a blogger on political and cultural topics at www.ricksincere.com. That's www.ricksincere.com. And in the middle is David Evans. David is an associate professor of computer science at UVA. He has his PhD from MIT. He does work on computer security, and he served as the citizen member of the Joint Subcommittee to Study Voting Equipment in the General Assembly, which recently reported to the General Assembly and is the impetus for several of those bills that are now being discussed in the Assembly. All right, a little bit of history. Well, the current debate that we're having is a uniquely American phenomenon. Uniquely American because voting machines don't exist in most of the rest of the world, including Western Europe, where one might think we find them. We really only have voting machines, I think about a third or a half of South America uses voting technology. Holland does because there's a machine manufacturer there. And the whole country of India uses electronic voting machines, which is quite interesting. Those machines are made by the Indian government. But other than that, everyone votes on good old paper ballots. So it's an American thing, but it's an American thing that goes far back. I think the first voting machines came into being around 1901. And they basically were the machines that much of us used until very recently. The old mechanical lever machines, and I think probably most of you in this room at one point or another has voted on those. You remember them with the big red handle that you pulled. Well, that was kind of the rule of the land, at least until the 1960s, which is when I believe punch cards first came into being, sometime in the mid-60s. And punch cards became a very popular form of voting. In the 1970s, I think it was, optical scan machines first appeared. And some of you have used optical scan machines. These are the ones where you shade in the bubble or connect the arrows on a paper ballot, essentially, and then it's fed into a machine that reads it and produces the results. Touchscreen voting didn't really appear until the early 1990s, maybe a few in the late 1980s, but they didn't really become popular until the mid-1990s. As for Charlottesville and Albemarle, Albemarle County used those old mechanical lever machines until 1994, when I was registrar and my electoral board got taken away by the bells and whistles of new electronic machines. So we bought something that by brand, it's called the AVC Advantage. And those of you in the county know what it looks like. It's a big machine. We call it a full-face machine because the whole ballot is in front of you. It's not really a touchscreen machine. It is a DRE machine, but it's a touch-button machine. You may think it's a touchscreen, but actually behind that ballot are a grid of buttons. And when you press that screen, you're actually pressing a button behind that screen. So we've had those since 1994, and that's still the major way we vote. Along the way, we added an optical scan machine for absentee balloters, and then recently added a touch screen for those absentee balloters who are voting in person. In the city, somewhere in the 1970s, I believe, Rick, you might know for sure, they adopted the punch card system. Exactly the same punch card system that was used in those places in Florida that had so many problems. And then in what, 2002, the city got touchscreen machines that are called eSlate. They're not touchscreen. Okay, you're going to tell us what they are. But anyway, those are the machines that we use here now. I think they're about six or seven different systems that are used around the state. Everyone now seems to have some sort of electronic machine, and that causes the debate that we're dealing with now. How did we get into this situation and this debate? Largely because after the 2000 presidential election, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, which mandated and paid for everybody to replace their punch card machines and their mechanical lever machines. And what was left? Basically electronic machines, either the touchscreen DREs or the optical scan styles of machines primarily. So now virtually the whole nation uses some form of electronics in voting. With that little history, I'll turn to our panelists, and first I'm going to ask Will to come up and talk a bit about the county's machines and about his views on electronic voting.
Thank you, Jim. I'm, of course, not going to pay any attention to what he said I'm here to speak about, at least initially, but obviously we will get into the subject matter. But first of all, I want to thank all of you for being here today. I'm not going to give you a bunch of BS about how important democracy is, because I don't think you'd be here if you didn't have some inkling of that. And I do want to let you know that having had Jim volunteer me to be here, I had the chance in the last couple of days to do a little bit of homework that was very refreshing, and finding out some things that I did not know. As you probably know, the Electoral Board in each jurisdiction in Virginia consists of three members, two members from the current governor's party and one member from the out party, to use a phrase that may not be quite as applicable as some others. But at any rate, I did all my homework. I did a great job this morning of updating the information that I wanted to bring to you, and I left it on my printer. It's the printer's fault. The other thing that I wanted to mention before I get into the meat of the subject is just to give you a little flavor for Albemarle County. For those of you who do not vote in the county, we have 28 precincts out in the county, plus one precinct that is dedicated to the absentee voters, and their job on election day is to make sure that all of those votes are counted. And the other thing that I think you'll find interesting about the county, for those of you who vote in the city or elsewhere, this year, because of the wonderful job that was done in redistricting a few years ago, we will have 11 or 12 different ballot faces on our machines. And if you think that that any of this is simple, just that fact alone will tell you that it's not. There are four House of Delegates districts in Albemarle County, and there are two Senate districts. How do we manage all of this? Well, I want to tell you that the Electoral Board is a small part. The lion's share of this work in making sure that our elections go as smoothly and as fairly as possible falls to the dedicated professional registrars who work day in and day out all year long to make sure that these things work and that the Electoral Board is paying attention to any problems that might come up. I can't speak for all of the jurisdictions in Virginia, but I can tell you that Sherry Iachetta in the city, Jake Washburn in the county, and our former registrar Jackie Harris in Fairfax County are hands-on folks who are looking out for all of you and everybody else who votes in Albemarle County and Charlottesville to make sure not only that we conduct fair elections, but that we do them as efficiently as possible. Is there ever going to be a perfect election in this country? Do you know of anything else in this country that's perfect? George Bush. Well, that goes without saying. The other critical factor to doing these elections are the volunteers who step up and agree to be election officials. In Albemarle County, I think we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 325 to 340 people for every major general election that I call them volunteers because, frankly, the amount that we pay them, they're volunteers. But these are folks who are not only willing on election day to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and be at their polling places at 5 o'clock to make sure that the machines are up and running and that all of the other supplies have been distributed, the polling books are in their places, and that we're ready to go when the voting public shows up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Do I think electronic voting machines are the biggest problem that we have with democracy in America? Hell no. I would suggest to you that there are a couple of other areas that we should be concentrating on, although I know it's not the subject this morning. But voter suppression, secretaries of state who also act as partisan campaign managers for certain people in certain jurisdictions, low turnout, a lack of voter education, the means by which absentee votes are collected and registered. And I also will point out that Virginia, I think, has been lucky over the years in running pretty darn good elections. For those of you who really want to get into this, I would recommend you go to electionline.org. They have put together about a 30-page report on last year's elections. And I want to just point out a couple of little things, and then I will talk a little bit about the security procedures that we go through in the county to try and make sure that some of the allegations in terms of hacking into these things and corrupting the process, I believe, prevent that for Albemarle County. The summary is there were few races in which polling place problems could have affected the outcome, but they correctly point out that the goal is whether every voter who showed up at a polling place had an opportunity to cast their vote without problems or obstacles. And the answer, of course, to that, unfortunately, is no. Human error, I would suggest, is as big a bugaboo in the election process as anything else, whether it comes down to voter error or volunteer error or other things like that. A simple example is during the recount for the Senate race, Senator Deeds running for Attorney General, the night of the election, as always, our precinct workers call in the vote totals after they have gotten them off the machines from the audit tapes that are in every single machine. Most of these machines keep track of the votes in two or three different places, so but the fact is that if someone after a 16 to 20 hour day calls in and says the vote is 325 instead of 532, that's certainly possible. Part of the protection against that becoming the final vote, of course, is the electoral board being there that night to look over precinct returns and hopefully being able to look at a precinct and right off the top of their head say, those numbers don't look right. Call them back and find out what the deal is. The other part of the vote process that should give us at least some support in knowing that they're done as well as we can is the next day in Virginia, every single electoral board meets with the registrar in the registrar's office so that we can go through not only all of the provisional ballots, but also once again check through all of the results that we've gotten from the night before and make sure that to the extent that we can, we check every single piece of paper that's come out of that, every single voting machine, to make sure that the numbers match up with what the statement of results show. There were a couple of just things that tickled me in here, and if you'll indulge me, I'll try and find them. Here are some mistakes that certainly involved electronic voting machines. I don't think you can blame them on the machine, though. Allentown, Pennsylvania man who apparently wanted to make a critique about the trustworthiness of electronic voting by smashing a $5,000 voting machine with a paperweight. Would the headline say, electronic voting machine didn't work? I bet it would. And another one where the squirrel chewed through the electrical cable in Oklahoma, which cut off power to voting machines at several polling stations. Now, The Electoral Board, working with the Registrar's Office and with our election manager, followed the procedures as are outlined by the Code of Virginia. And in working with our vendor, we go through a process of making sure that all of the 97 AVC machines in the county are put through a test run with a tape runoff to show what the vote was. The vendor goes through a process of making sure that he votes every single combination possible on the ballot, and we run that tape off and keep it with all of our other information. Our machines are currently stored in a facility that is owned by the County of Albemarle. It's in the old Wachovia Bank Center down on 5th Street South. And we've been in there for, I'm guessing, 3 or 4 years now. Would we like more space? Absolutely. Do we think it's secure? Yes, we do. One of the reasons that we think that is because the only person who has access is the board and our elections manager. Our vendor is never, never in that room without elections manager. The other thing that I think, at least to my mind, gives me some sense of safety in the storage facility is it's right next door to the police department. Could you break in? Yep. Would you get caught? Probably. Could you actually do something if you were in there? Yeah, you could take something and smash the machines, and that would probably be the best damage you could do to make sure we couldn't use them. But we follow, particularly for a big election, which we are facing again this year. This fall, we will be electing the entire General Assembly, as well as constitutional officers, school board, in Albemarle County anyway. And it's a year-round process of having the registrar and the elections manager work together with the vendor to make sure not only that the machines are properly cared for, and part of that is simply a process of making sure that they are powered up on a regular basis, because these machines, not only on election day can you plug them into the wall, and that's generally how they run, but they also have batteries in them that would allow them to run an entire, I actually think it's 48 hours, but I can't recall off the top of my head, anybody, 48? Right, it would run at least the election day and probably then some. So what we do is go through what is mandated by the Code of Virginia to try and make sure that we run through all of the procedures, make sure that the machines work to the extent that we can. And of course, on election day, all of the machines work perfectly 100% of the time. We've never had a problem. Not really. But I can tell you, I think, fairly safely that one thing that we've tried to do is, number one, and I'm sure the city does the same, most jurisdictions do the same, the first thing that election officials do when they get to the polling places is get their machines up and running and make sure that the voter tape is run showing that there are no votes on that machine before we start. The all during the day we take counts. The election chiefs are in correspondence with the registrar's office all day long. The registrar's office has the ability to contact every single member of the board all day long, and as questions come up or problems arise, we try just as fast as we can to get them taken care of. On every election day, we have a machine technician here, not just on call from somewhere else. He's here. He's sitting in the registrar's office with a deputy sheriff, who, of course, adds that extra speed to getting the technician out to the trouble places. And in worst-case scenario, if we had a problem with the machine, we would still be able to run the tapes for all of the votes that have been recorded up to that time, even if we found that the machine was not operating properly and we had to shut it down. Now, our board has taken the position a number of times. Well, let me back up. Before every election, we try and figure out how big the turnout's going to be. And I'd like to say that we get 100% turnout, but you all know I'd be lying. And then we try and determine how many machines we think should be in each of the precincts. Now, for every precinct, you're going to have a minimum of two. And there are some small precincts that maybe two would be enough, and oftentimes that is the case. But with Albemarle County growing the way it is, we're facing a need for more machines and more precincts. I think the only thing that when I was still chair, Rob Bell and I agreed on one thing, and it may have been the only thing we agreed on. Neither one of us wanted more precincts, because the number of precincts you have obviously ups the ante in terms of how many volunteers you have to have and how many machines you have to have. It's an important point to agree on, but it was probably the only one. But we determine how many we think we're going to need. If there's a question as to whether you need two or three, you get three. Do we get election officials sometimes complaining, why did you give me so many machines? I don't want to open them all up. I don't want to keep track of them. Yeah. And what we tell them is, we don't ever want a situation to arise when you don't have machines that don't work. So if you don't want to open a machine because you don't think you need it, that's fine. But it's going to be in your polling place in case that situation arises where maybe one goes down and you want to still keep the flow of people going through. I could probably go on and on, mostly about what I've learned in the last few days, because except for practical knowledge and the meetings that we have every month to discuss all of these things, I found the election line information very interesting. I did read through all of the bills that Jim referenced that are in front of the General Assembly. Another part of democracy that I think everybody ought to pay more attention to is going down to the General Assembly and just take a look at what these people are doing. Just see how they're acting towards themselves. You'll see in this morning's paper that they once again decided that there's no need to take a vote before you kill bills. But what's their answer? Well, they did it. That's how they used to do it. Okay, great. That's a good explanation. I will leave you with the thought that I mentioned some of the things that I think are more important in terms of safeguarding our democracy and our voting system. But I think that the bottom line is, yes, electronic voting machines have eased the amount of work that we expect out of our volunteers. I believe that for the most part they are accurate and do record most of the votes. As I said, I don't think there's a perfect system. If someone can show us one, I'd be happy to take into consideration how to implement it, assuming the county will pay for it. And the other critical factor is if you know someone who really wants to understand how the election system works and how these electronic voting machines work, tell them to volunteer to be an election official. We'd be happy to show them. Thank you.
I'm just curious, how many people here are election officials or have been so in the last 5 years? Okay, got a good handful. And I would like to, since both Russ and Will alluded to registrars here, I would like to make it clear that we do have in the audience the current county registrar, the current city registrar, and the current Fairfax County registrar and former county registrar. And even though this is a Democratic-sponsored event, I want to assure everyone that they are here in their nonpartisan professional roles. Right? Okay. And now I'd like to introduce Rick Sincere.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to be here today. And I think one of the things my presence demonstrates here is the nonpartisan nature of this particular issue. People disagree on the questions of electronic voting machines and how we should run elections, but it never really seems to be along partisan lines. It's almost always along lines of practical questions of how things should be run best. If you go to the General Assembly right now, you'll find that some of the bills dealing with electronic voting machines are sponsored by Republicans, and some are sponsored by Democrats. And actually, I found myself mostly in the position of disagreeing with the Republican sponsors of these bills, because I think they're misguided. A lot of what Will had to say was also on my mind this morning, so I don't want to repeat too much of what he said, but I do want to get into some more details. First of all, I'd like to expand a bit on Jim's history lesson from this morning. If you go way back in American history, the way people voted was they would gather in a room like this, and someone would call out the names of the candidates, and they would raise their hands. It was a very public process. Some of you might have read about when George Washington was running for the House of Delegates, his main expenditure, his campaign expenditure, was 12 pounds for several gallons of whiskey. In those days, voting was a very public, celebratory event. People got together all day long, and they would discuss who they would want to send to the House of Delegates or to Congress. It would be like the Iowa caucuses are. If any of you have observed the Iowa caucus method of selecting precinct delegates to go to the state convention and eventually to the national convention. We've progressed. And then as time went on, we developed the idea of paper ballots. But those ballots were issued by the political parties, and they were different colors, and they were called tickets. When we talk today about a ticket, vice president and president running on the same ticket, that's where the term derived from. And when you went to vote, you would put, say, a blue piece of paper in the ballot box or a white piece of paper, and everybody would know what party you were voting for. And then about 10 or 15 years after the Civil War, we introduced what's called the Australian ballot or the secret ballot, in which the ballot was printed and issued by the government so that when you went to vote, you might drop a piece of paper in the ballot box, but nobody would know who you were voting for because all the candidates' names appeared on the same ballot and you would have to check off the name. You weren't voting a straight ticket and you weren't demonstrating to your neighbors who you were voting for. I think that's progress, too. And then over time, we developed the mechanical lever machines that Jim mentioned, and then eventually punch cards and DREs. The first direct recording electronic device was introduced about 1984. And as John Fund points out in his book about election fraud called Stealing Elections, in the 20-plus years that we have been using electronic voting machines, there has not been a single verifiable case of tampering with those machines to change the outcome of an election. That's a long history of good practice that we should be aware of. As Will was saying, the most important factor in our elections are our election officials. And I think those of you who have worked as election officials and are now election officials, you really deserve a big round of applause because you are our first line in making sure that elections are conducted with transparency, with security, and with integrity. And it's really important that the people who volunteer to work as election officials maintain those qualities. And that's the main point in terms of tampering with machines, is that in order to change the outcome of an election by tampering with a machine, you have to have physical access to that machine. And as long as elections are public events in which people come into a room and there are other people present, whether they are election officials, government officials, or simply other voters, those machines are more secure than if you were voting alone at home, say, over the internet, which is a proposal that I would not support. Some of you may have seen a video that was virally transmitted last year that emanated from Princeton University that shows that you can unscrew the bottom of a machine and replace the software and do this in less than a minute. We showed that video to our election officials during training last fall, and they all laughed at it because they realized how impossible that would be under real-life voting conditions. It's simply not possible for someone to come into a voting place with tens or dozens of people present and try to take a machine out of its space, turn it over, turn it upside down, unscrew it in front of all these people. It simply is a laughable situation. That could only happen if someone is given access to the machine prior to an election by someone in charge. And what would really only happen is you're calling into the question the integrity of election officials. And if you can't trust election officials, the registrars, the electoral board members, the technicians, with electronic voting machines, you probably can't trust them with any sort of technology in running elections. And that's where I would actually take issue with something Russ mentioned before about the mail-in ballots in Oregon. I don't like the Oregon system at all, because if you look over time where election fraud takes place, it is almost always with paper, either at the level of registering to vote. There was an example in Nevada a couple years ago where these groups went and registered people to vote and then dumped all the registration forms in a dumpster. And the people showed up on election day and they said, well, I'm registered to vote. But no, they weren't, because the nonprofit advocacy group that ran the voter registration drive was conducting a fraudulent drive. They were trying to get people to think they were registered to vote, but they really weren't. And I think there are some bills before the General Assembly this year that would increase penalties for that kind of fraudulent registration. Paper ballots are most easily manipulated, far more easy to manipulate than any electronic voting machine. All you need to change the results of an election with paper ballots is a pen or a pencil to make that ballot unreadable, to change the choice that a voter made. And the other question you have, especially in Oregon, is because they have ended the community act of voting by letting everybody vote in the privacy of their home, you never know whether someone is being coerced or intimidated to vote for someone that they really don't want to vote for. You have ended the integrity of the election by turning into a very private matter. Voting is not private. Voting is something that belongs to all of us. And that's why I want to get back to the machines we use in Charlottesville. The eSlate is not a touchscreen voting machine. And it's a common mistake, and I don't blame Jim for making it, because it looks like a touchscreen machine, but it isn't. You don't have to touch the screen at all. Those of you who are familiar with the way an iPod or a BlackBerry works, and those of you who do vote in Charlottesville know how the eSlate works. You turn a dial that moves the names of the candidates or the ballot issues, or if you're doing a write-in vote, it moves the letters on the machine, and then you press a button to indicate your choice. You don't have to touch the screen at all, so it doesn't have any of the questions of calibrating the touch screen to make sure that people are voting for the right candidate. You may have heard reports from other jurisdictions where people will press candidate A and candidate B keeps coming up. This is very rare. That's why it's reported in the newspapers, but it is possible to happen. So those are the basic points I want to make. I want to reiterate what Will was talking about in terms of the canvas. That's a very important process. I don't think many of you are aware, but when the Electoral Board conducts a canvas after the election, that is a public meeting. Anyone, any member of the public can come and observe. And I know that Russ has been at several of our canvases in the past. Last year, I think Tom Vandiver was at our canvas and observed the process. And certainly anyone who is concerned about the integrity of the process should be able to watch that. And you'll see how meticulous we are in making sure that everything matches up. I think it was after our city council meeting last May, my predecessor on the electoral board, Leroy Hamlet, was helping us with the canvas, and he spent 5 or 6 hours trying to figure out why the count on the number of voters on our absentee rolls was one off. Is that right, Jerry? Yeah. He spent 5 or 6 hours. Yeah. This is the sort of thing we do to make sure. And it's not a matter of are we off by 12 or 15. So are we off by one? And if we're off by one, we try to find out what's wrong and fix it. And I would say in 99 out of 100 cases, we are able to figure out where the error was made, and we can fix it. And that's really important because a lot of what you hear in terms of large-scale election fraud is, you know, there were, you know, 350 votes cast in a precinct where there were only 250 registered voters. That can't happen here. You know, we know that at the beginning of the day there are zero voters, zero votes cast, and over the course of the day numbers of voters come in, and at the end of the day we know that if there were 100 voters who came in to vote, that that there should be 100 ballots cast, unless, as sometimes happens, people leave the voting booth without pressing that cast vote button. And we figure that out because our election chiefs are instructed to write down on an incident report, voter left booth without casting vote. And so that we figure that out, that all adds up. And if there's no report, then we have to find out what went wrong here. And we go back to our chief and say, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we had a problem with the machine. What was going on? And all of those incident reports are kept on permanent record. We've got, well, maybe not permanent, but at least 4 years. And if somebody has a question about what happened during the election, they can go back and look at the files and say, okay, this is the question I had. How many people voted in, say, Tonsler precinct? How many votes were cast? What were the problems that occurred on that day? What was done to rectify those problems? Right now, we'll answer questions in a little while. Right now we're considering in Charlottesville redrawing our precinct lines in order to make our elections more customer friendly in the sense that our voters are our customers. We've discovered that some of our precincts are underutilized. Alumni Hall, for instance. I don't know whether any of you vote there, but we've got Bitsy votes there. There's a large room that has very few voters, fewer voters than one would expect given the number of registered voters in that precinct. Unfortunately, in places like Tonsler, there's little room and a lot of voters in comparison. So we're looking into redrawing our precinct lines, and we're hoping that City Council will be appointing a committee to help the Electoral Board and the Registrar's Office in figuring out the most efficient way of organizing our elections. And that is what's really important to voters in terms of knowing that we are doing our jobs, is that when they come to vote on Election Day, they can do so in an expeditious manner with nobody impeding them and with the sense that they've done their civic duty and they can go home and know that the election officials are doing their job to secure the machines and to make sure that all the votes are counted the next day. And we'll be happy to answer all of your questions, but I'll turn it over to Jim now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it sounds like everything is just fine with electronic voting machines, doesn't it? David Evans. David may think otherwise.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you for inviting me to come out and speak, and especially thank all the election officials and registrars who have come out today. One of the things that often happens in discussions about electronic voting is it ends up seeming like an attack on election officials, and I want to make sure that people understand that that's not the case, that I think it's tremendous the work that election officials and registrars do, and given the situation that we're in, things work amazingly well. And that's thanks to all the efforts that volunteers and election officials and the registrars put into it. But there fighting against a system which makes things a lot harder for elections to do what they're supposed to do than they should be. And I want to make it a little interactive by first asking the audience, what is the main thing that elections are supposed to do? So anyone want to offer an answer to that? Sorry? Elect Democrats. Okay. Maybe most of this audience will agree with that. There are probably a few who might disagree. Sorry?
To count the votes and all be counted.
Okay. To count the votes and make sure they're all counted. Okay. Definitely, they have an important role in getting citizens to participate in the political process. Anything else? An accurate vote count? Okay. Yes? Okay, so I think that's really getting at what I think is the most important thing elections have to do, which is to convince the losers that they lost, right? If the election doesn't convince the losers that they lost, well, you don't have a democracy. You have coups, you have fighting in the streets. We're pretty fortunate in the U.S. that we don't get into that the first time losers are upset or losers think the election was rigged. But this is what happens in places where people don't trust elections, where people who lose elections don't believe that they lost and find some other way to try to stay in power or to try to get in power. So that's the number one thing elections have to do, is to convince the losers that they lost. You hope that they also actually pick the right winners and losers. But whoever they pick as the winners and losers, if the losers aren't convinced that they lost, we have a big problem. And we've certainly seen that in the Florida 2000 election was probably the biggest case where the losers were not convinced that they lost. And I think probably most people in this room were not convinced that the right outcome happened in that election. So how well do DREs work for this purpose? So that's the main focus of what I'm going to talk about. And it's starting from the perspective, I'm a computer scientist. And if you talk to technology professionals, if you talk to people who work on software, essentially, all of them think DREs are a bad idea. There's vast agreement among people who are professionals in computer science, in technology and security, that DREs are a very dangerous way to do elections and that they're better alternatives to what we're doing. And this seems strange, right? Because we're people who work in technology. We love technology. We think computing has done wonderful things for society and is continuing to be the way of progress and the way to make most things better. Why do all the people who are most involved in technology think technology in DREs is a bad way to do voting? And the reason for that is that voting is a really tough problem. Conducting elections in the way that serves this purpose of convincing the losers that they lost and has all the other properties that elections are supposed to have is a really hard problem, and it's very different from the other problems that we use software to solve. So we're willing to trust software to manage our banking. We're willing to trust it with all our money. We're willing to trust it to fly airplanes. We're willing to trust it to do eye surgery. All these really important life-critical tasks we're willing to trust on software. So it seems strange that something that seems apparently much simpler than that, much simpler than controlling an airplane, such as voting, that we can't trust that to software only. So there's some really critical things that make voting different. The first one is that for voting, we want to have accountability. Right? We want to be able to know that the votes were counted right. But we also need to have privacy. Right? So we have this battle of we want to be able to account that we got the right result, but we can't record the things that we need to be able to do that accounting. Right? We need to keep individual votes private. This makes accountability very difficult. We can't do auditing at the level of individual voters checking that their vote was counted correctly because we don't want to record individual voters and who they voted for. So this is this battle between we want transparency, right? At a system level, we need to be able to see as much as we can about how the election was conducted to know that the result was computed correctly, but we want privacy for individuals. We have the same problem with accountability and auditability, right? We'd like to be able to audit the election, know that it was conducted correctly, but we can't audit at the level of revealing individual votes. The other thing that's really hard about voting and that's different from the other critical things that we use software for is we have this massive sudden deployment, right? Every year on election day, massive sudden deployment, right? The voting machines are used on election day in a large, huge use. They're not used any other day of the year. They're not gradually scaled out the way if there's new software for ATMs, well, you roll it out gradually. You don't replace everything at once. You can do tests. You have this accountability and auditing that you can do to see that it's worked before you've broken the entire system. With voting machines, well, we don't have that opportunity. Everything is deployed very suddenly on election day. If something's broken and we discover it later, well, it's too late to do anything about it. There's some other specific things that are wrong about the way DREs are dealt with that are fixable. Right? So the problem of transparency versus privacy, that's kind of a fundamental issue. The way DREs are regulated is very limited. There's no inspection of the software. And we get into lots of issues with DREs, touchscreens, all these names. The real crux of it is whether it's software only. Right? Whether there's no record of the voting, whether there's nothing controlling the voting process other than some code that some vendor wrote that's running in the machine. And you hope it's the code that the vendor wrote that's running in the machine, but you have no way to know for sure what code's actually running in the machine. And both Will and Rick talked about having a lot of confidence that the machines couldn't be tampered with. And said Will Harvey said that, you know, the only person who has access to the machines is the board and the election managers. Rick said that this video of the Princeton computer scientists where they tampered with the machine and showed that you could modify the code and it would spread to other machines and be able to control how the votes were counted, that couldn't possibly happen in a real election because of all these safeguards where there are people watching the rooms and it would be hard to do that. And I can say both of those is not actually true from my own experience. So I voted absentee in Albemarle County. I voted at the DMV on Route 250. And what happened when I voted was I was taken into a room by myself that had two DRE voting machines in it, and I was left alone there with a door that closed and that had a lock on it. So I had at least, as long as I took was about 10 minutes, but I could have taken plenty longer, alone with two voting machines that were set up that were actually conducting a live election. And these were happened to be different machines than the ones in the Princeton video, but certainly I had every opportunity to change the code on those machines if they were the Princeton ones or if I knew about the ones that were there, with no one watching me, with no controls, and these were live machines that were being used in Albemarle County for the election in 2006. So it's very hard to say that we can make these guarantees that no one could tamper with machines. They're always out there. It's very hard to physically safeguard them. It's troubling that the ones in Albemarle County weren't guarded better than they were, but these are physical objects. There's always going to be opportunities that people will have access to them. And I know, at least in this last election that I did, so certainly it's not the case that we can be super confident that, you know, I didn't actually try to tamper with the machine, but we certainly can't be confident that no one else could have. So in the introduction, Russ mentioned that the Florida 2000 election that led to this HAVA Act that led to a lot of the DRE equipment. And when people look at the Florida 2000 election, they look at these pictures of you know, the guy holding up the punch card ballot, staring at it with a magnifying glass, trying to figure out what the vote was. And that's what people look at and say, oh, that's what went wrong. But really, that's what went right about the Florida election. Right? The fact that there were ballots that could be looked at again, that could be recounted, if that was all that happened in Florida 2000, well, that's the way elections are supposed to happen, right? The fact that there was something you could look at to try to figure out what the correct result of the election is correct. Certainly there are problems with the punch card. There were big problems with the way the ballots were designed in Palm Beach. But the other things that went wrong were all not the fact that you could look at these punch card ballots and try to recount them, right? That's really what we want. And when we look at the 2006 election in Sarasota, which Russ also mentioned in the intro, here we have a situation where there's nothing to recount. From the results, it looks like something fishy happened. We have 18,000 voters
who went to the polls and didn't vote in the major race. We have the candidate, Christine Jennings, who lost by just 373 votes out of more than 200,000. And those counties that had this no-vote rate was 13% in those counties versus 2% in other counties that were using other equipment. And the candidate has been appealing to try to get access to the source code for the voting machines that were used in those counties to find out if something could have been wrong with the way they were set up or how the votes were recorded. A judge denied this. It's currently under appeal. But there's nothing like a punch card that we can look at and say, well, was the vote that was recorded the correct vote? All we have is the numbers that the computers are spitting out at the end of the election, which appear to be very confusing, with 18,000 voters showing up to the polls and not voting in this race. So there was a committee set up in Virginia about 2 years ago to look at voting equipment. Virginia is a little bit slow in this. Many other states have already passed laws to require paper trails. But this subcommittee was set up last year. I was one of two citizen members on the committee that had technical expertise. The committee was created by Senator Tim Hugo and Devilites Davis. And it's led to two bills that are in pending currently. And those bills are bills that are trying to require that we have some way of recounting elections, that we have some way of verifying that elections couldn't be corrupted by software-only machines that have no way of recording what voters actually intended. So the bill is SB 840 and HB 2707. And what they require is to use optical scan voting machines. And this is the best solution that's readily available today. By most analyses, it costs less than the DRE software-only machines. And the way it works is a voter will, either using a machine or using hand marking, will mark a paper ballot and then scan it through one of these optical scan machines. The scan machine will read the ballot and report the results to the voter so they can see that it's reading the markings on the ballot the way they were intended. And the voter can decide if it doesn't read them correctly or there was a mistake in the ballot, not to count that ballot, to redo the ballot, or can decide to cast the ballot. There's some other things in the bill to ban wireless communications. So certainly having voting machines that have wireless communication opens up a lot of new security flaws. One of the things I want to mention, so the software that's running inside the DRE, most of them it's Windows. But these are not simple machines. So this is the big difference between the voting machines that are used in Brazil and India that were mentioned in the introduction. Those are running very simple software. They're very simple machines. Part of this is because elections are simpler in those countries, that they usually have much smaller, simpler standard ballots than what we have to deal with here. But the machines were designed to be simple. And the problem with the software that's in the DREs that we have today, it's not just the software for doing election. It's running on top of Windows. Many of you probably have some experience running your home computers on top of Windows. Maybe you're really lucky, but most people who run Windows run into some problems with it. You've probably had machines crash. You've probably had documents corrupted. Windows is a very, very complicated system. It's got about 50 million lines of code in it. So any of those lines of code are actually still running inside the voting machine, as well as the software that the voting vendor uses for the voting application. So we're dealing with very complicated machines. If there's any flaws in that software, even if they're not intentional, they can change the result. This happens more with touchscreens than with the eSlate machines that Charlottesville has. Just because there's one particular problem that touchscreens have that make them even worse is you have to have a calibration between the screen and the software. So when you touch the screen, for the software to figure out where you're touching on the screen is a hard problem. And if that's not calibrated correctly, you can click on one candidate and it can record that you click somewhere else and record the vote for the other candidate. So the other things in the bills that have been proposed are to have random audits of the machines. So we have both the paper record from the scan ballots and the tally that's recorded in the machine. So we have two things that record the intent of the voters. We have a way of auditing the machines to check that they're correct. We also have a way of, if there's a dispute, we have the ultimate record, which is the paper record that the voter looked at and approved was correct. So I think that's probably enough to get a discussion going. There is a coalition that's working to support these bills, which is the Verifiable Voting Coalition of Virginia, and their website is www.vavv.org. So I hope some of you will look at that and consider trying to help get these bills supported. And I also want to mention that Senator Craig Deeds is a co-sponsor of the bill in the Senate, so at least the Charlottesville Senate representative is co-sponsoring this bill. Yes? Yes, it's www.vavv.org. Thanks.
I want to give Rick and Will a chance to respond to anything that they want to respond to that David said. And I have a couple questions, and then we're going to open it up to all of you. I don't think we need to use the podium anymore unless you all prefer to. Everybody all right if I toss this aside? Okay. And would anyone like to respond to anything that David said?
Well, I'm not sure we have all day, but I did want to address the shocking fact that he was left alone with two machines. He mentioned first off that there is a part of the balancing act is between accountability and privacy, and part of why he was allowed to vote in that room with the door closed is a privacy issue. Did he have time to somehow bring in new code and put it in the machine and tamper with the rest of the election for everyone else? I think it's highly unlikely. First of all of these machines have seals on them that are checked after almost every single voter comes in, votes. The election, the registrar or someone on their staff goes into the room to make sure that the machine is ready for the next voter, checks the seals, checks the back of the machine to make sure that it hasn't been opened or anything else like that. I would suggest that if David had, in fact, taken the opportunity to tamper with the machine, he wouldn't be here today. He'd be at the Charlottesville Albemarle Joint Security Complex. We would waste no time whatsoever if we found that a machine had been tampered with to call in the police. Secondly, in order to change the cartridge in a machine, which I assume is what you're talking about in terms of being able to affect the outcome, the machine wouldn't take it. If you open the machine, assuming you broke the seals and you opened the machine and took the cartridge out, the machine would then say, basically, service needed, machine down, call technician. If you somehow were able to get the cartridge out because you turned the machine off and put your own cartridge in, that cartridge would not match up with the software that's already in the machine, and it would not operate. Now, there will be some people, and I'm sure that there's probably an answer to that as well, as there always is, and I don't think that either Rick nor I said that there weren't any problems out there. There are. We admit them. We try and deal with them as soon as we can. And I would tell you that at least from my perception, for having done this about 4 years, is that to the extent that those mistakes and errors, whether machine or human, to the extent that they affect an election, I would think not.
I would reiterate what Will said in terms of how the machines in Charlottesville work. Exactly the same thing would happen if they were tampered with. Before every election, absentee voting starts 45 days before the regular election day, and then we have what's called a logic and accuracy test and a lockdown of the machines, in which a numbered seal is put on each machine so that we could tell whether it's been tampered with. And And each of our machines, what we call the JBC, the Judge's Booth Controller. Those of you who vote with in Charlottesville know you walk up to an election official and they're sitting at this gray panel and they press a button and you're given an access code that you take to your eSlate machine where you cast your vote. Each of those JBCs is sealed, and inside it has something called a mobile ballot box. No one has access to those mobile ballot boxes except the electoral board, the registrar, and the technicians in the safety and security of the registrar's office. In fact, last October, when we had training for our election officials, I asked whether any of them, any of the election officials who work out in the precincts, had ever seen or touched a mobile ballot box, and none of them had. They know it's inside the machine, but they've never seen one because that this is something that is extremely secure. Also, the machines we use in Charlottesville, the eSlate, have a triple redundancy in terms of keeping track of votes. Each of the eSlates records the votes that are in that eSlate. The JBC records the votes on the mobile ballot box and also on a hard drive that's inside the JBC. So if there's any breakdown anywhere along the line, we have a record of how those votes were cast. Also, we have what's called the cast vote record, which is basically a PDF printout of how each individual voter casts his or her set of votes. So, for instance, if we had an election where there's a president, Congress, you know, president, Senate, Congress, and a ballot measure, you would be able to go back and check for your own vote if you, for instance, wrote in something very idiosyncratic, which is something I've done to test the integrity of the election. And those are a matter of public record. I mean, if you vote in, say, Jefferson Park Precinct, you can go to the registrar's office and say, I would like to see the cast vote records for Jefferson Park Precinct on the November 2006 election. It'll take a while to make the copies. But we can give it to you on a CD, those are also available in the library. We make sure that those are deposited at the Jefferson Madison Regional Library because it is a matter of public record. And you can go back and check to make sure that the votes are counted accurately. For those of you who are more involved in sort of the strategic planning of elections, this is a marvelous tool for figuring out how people are voting in the various patterns, especially in terms of local elections. We found some very interesting combinations in some recent city council elections that you could look at. And finally, to my understanding, the Hart eSlate is not Windows-based. It's got about 750,000 lines of code, not 50 million. So it would be much easier to detect any software glitches. And all of us who in Charlottesville are real boosters of the Hart eSlate system, and we recommend it to everyone. And the final point that I would make before Jim continues with the questions and answers is that one of the real guarantees of the integrity of elections is the fact that so many jurisdictions, every jurisdiction uses a different system. Albemarle uses a different system from Charlottesville. Charlottesville uses a different system from Harrisonburg. Harrisonburg uses a different system than Rockingham County. This makes it very difficult for anyone to change the results of an election. Just take, for instance, the 57th House of Delegates District, which consists of 8 precincts in Charlottesville, 8 precincts in Albemarle County. In order to change the results of the election by tampering with the machines, you would have to know both software systems, plus you would have to involve the complicity of election officials in both the county and the city in order to get at those machines to tamper with them. And the levels of security increase the more different systems we have. As of 2 years ago, there were 22 different systems in use in Virginia, including, at that time, Highland County, which was the last county to use only paper ballots. They've since switched to DREs. And I think that really is an assurance that we can keep the overall election system safe and secure.
So, a lot of things to respond to. I'll try to make it quick. So, on the last point about saying we're more secure because different precincts are using different systems, that's true in some sense in terms of, you know, really large scale tampering. That to tamper with all those systems would be more difficult than if they were all running the same system. But certainly, there's enough running the same system that you could tamper with most elections by just tampering with the one type of machine that's running in enough precincts to be useful, unless you're saying that none of them are running in enough precincts to change the results of an election, which seems to make a lot of votes not count.
But keep in mind that in every jurisdiction, they're running a different kind of ballot.
So the fact that all these different systems are out there in different ways means there's lots more opportunities for an attacker to find a vulnerability. Right? The attacker just needs to find one vulnerability in one of these systems, and then has, if there's enough opportunity in the precinct that's running that system, to tamper with election. So there are some benefits to having lots of different systems, but there's also more risk there, that there are more opportunities for an attacker to find one system that's vulnerable. On the points that Will made about me being in jail, which thankfully I'm not, because I didn't tamper with the machine, and I'm not going to try to have a more convincing argument next time that says I actually did tamper with the machine, because I don't want to end up in jail. I think it would be interesting if we can set up some kind of controlled environment where perhaps we could have two machines, and I have an opportunity to tamper with one of them, and then the election officials have to figure out which one was tampered with. I think that would be an interesting experiment to do. I'm not sure if we can set that up. The seal is, at least on the Diebold machines, and I'm not sure what it is on the machines in Albemarle County, but on the machines that the Princeton video shows them tampering with, and it took about a minute for them to load their own software into the machine. And once you have power to do that, you can really get it, you know, do anything you want. So once you've loaded your own software in the machine, it's easy to pass all the logic and accuracy tests and still corrupt the election. So there's not a lot of confidence in the fact that those tests are run again afterwards. And I won't get too much into that unless people ask of how you could make it pass the logic and accuracy tests but still corrupt the election. But there's a lot of things that the software can notice about whether it's running logic and accuracy tests or whether it's running a real election and behave differently in those cases. But the tape is just tape. It's tamper-proof tape. It's tape that even if you stick back the original tape, you can probably stick back it in a way that it's hard to see if it's been tampered with. But you can also just buy the tape yourself and put new tamper-proof tape on it, just like the original tamper-proof tape. And so anyone can buy the tape and replace the tamper-proof tape. So I think if we're relying on being able to see this tape seal hasn't been broken, that's a pretty risky thing to be relying on to know that the software on the machines is correct.
Well, let me just add, we don't use tape to make our machines tamper-proof. Yeah, it's a wire seal. It has to be cut.
It's something you stick on the machine. This is what the Diebold
machine
is.
No, it's a wire seal.
I'm what the Diebold machine, I'm not sure. I'm sure what you're talking about is correct, but what the Diebold machines in the video use is just sticky tape.
Well, that just shows that the people who made the video don't know how actual elections are run.
No, those were the actual Diebold machines.
One of the things I find in this
machines.
Debate...
The people who made the video know a lot about how elections are run.
This debate has generally been between election officials who know a lot about how elections are run and computer specialists who know a lot about computers, and little, if anything, about how elections are run.
Well, and, so this isn't true. So the people who made the tape, Ed Felton's a professor at Princeton. Avi Rubin is one of the most outspoken people on requiring paper trails and was involved in that and looked at the tape and what they did. Avi Rubin has been a volunteer as an elections official in Maryland. He's had that experience. He's written
about
it.
Let's not talk about Maryland. They don't know how to run elections there.
Well, so all of this, and I agree that, you know, what's being done in Charlottesville, and I think the InterCivic machines are much better than most of the alternatives, is better than what's
being done.
Let's
quote you on that. Make sure that the people at Heart... Right.
I'm not endorsing anything, by the way.
Yeah, let's have the moderator.
There's various degrees of...
And I'm just going to ask maybe one question. I've got a whole list, but it's already 11 o'clock, and I want to give you all a chance. But to dovetail on what you're just talking about here, can you say a little bit more about what legal safeguards we have in Virginia, not while the election's going on, but while the machine is getting programmed? What do we have to safeguard us and the political parties to know that those machines have been programmed correctly? And additional question to that, for all three of you, do you think we do it better in Virginia and that we have more safeguards in Virginia than most other states? Rick, I'll let you take that first.
Well, a lot of what I know about other states is anecdotal. We just mentioned Maryland, and we know what a mess that was in Montgomery County and some other jurisdictions during their primary election last September, where, for instance, people went to vote and found out that they didn't have the access cards that were necessary to run the voting machines, and there were long lines, and they were using provisional ballots made out of scrap paper. I've learned that training of election officials in Maryland is dismal. For instance, one election official was told by her trainer that don't worry about provisional ballots, they're not counted anyway. Well, anyone who votes in Virginia knows that we have a long tradition, even before the Help America Vote Act mandated provisional ballots nationwide. We've had conditional ballots here for a long, long time, and those are counted. They are part of the vote totals. An example from, say, Washington State, a couple of years ago, there was a disputed election there. In Washington State, about 80% of the ballots are on paper, and they were unusually liberal in allowing people to vote who were not qualified. In fact, a few weeks after the election, the State Board of Elections here in Richmond received 27 ballots from Virginia voters who went to vote in Washington State, and they were allowed to cast provisional votes there, even though they were not registered to vote in Washington, and they certainly could not vote in Virginia because they were not present and had not requested an absentee ballot here. And, of course, we won't accept any ballots like that. But it just goes to show the low standards of accountability in other states. I think Virginia has a very good system that from certification of election equipment on down to the penalties in terms of felonies for breaking election laws.
I agree we're doing a lot better than Maryland. I think we're doing a lot worse than we could be and a lot worse than many other states. I identify North Carolina, California, and Minnesota as three states that are doing much better than Virginia's, and I'm sure there are others. I think we're probably doing about as well as Florida is now. So certainly what happened in Sarasota in the last election could happen here. We're lucky it didn't, and we're lucky that the Senate race was not close enough to need a recount. But certainly if it did, we would have lots of problems here with not having anything to do a valid recount with.
I think what Jim was leading into is sort of the certification process and the fact that when we do run all of our testing, both parties and any representative of an independent candidate are notified well in advance that they have the right to be there and to watch the whole process, ask any questions that they have. In terms of, and I meant a disclaimer at the front, not only am I not a computer whiz, ask my kids, but I also think that a little bit of this, and not to disparage David in any way at all, because I'm sure he wouldn't be included in this group, but does anybody remember Y2K? Not quite old enough. I would suggest to you that some of the hysteria that surrounded Y2K has now been transferred to this whole hoopla about electronic voting machines. Again, they're not perfect, neither is this microphone. But whatever no means. I'm certainly not saying that we shouldn't examine every single step and process that we go through in the elections. But I would suggest to you that when the Maryland election headlines in their primary was election machines fail, read the headline, then read the story. And the story was that election officials failed to get the access cards out to the precincts so that the machines could be used. But it's reported as an election machine failure. I think not. Human error is there. And that's about it.
Yes, ma'am.
I have one quick question for Rick about something he said, and then I have a general question. The quick question is, you said election officials make an incident report if a voter leaves the booth without pressing the cast ballot button. Does the election official say, "Hey, buddy, you forgot to press the cast ballot button"?
If they know before the person has left the voting precinct, yes. But sometimes they're not aware that the ballot has not been cast until the person is long gone.
And sometimes the person will not return to the booth to complete the effort. They're embarrassed.
Okay, my general question. Before each election in the city and the county, they test the machine by voting each combination once. What if the software were programmed so that every 20th vote, if it was for a Democrat, was recorded as a vote for the Republican? You wouldn't discover that. Have you ever tested the machines by running a little mini election with, say, 5,000 votes?
Yes.
And I will say on that subject also that the state, I believe, is in the process of promulgating new procedures that are going to require much more complex pre-testing with lots of different combinations like you're suggesting. So they're in the process of doing that at the State Board of Elections.
So can I make one comment on that? So certainly you can do the kinds of testing where you test more votes. One thing we always have in our elections is the way to do write-in votes. So someone who wants to tamper with the software could easily tamper with it in a way that the software behaves normally until there's a write-in vote for a very specific name that they made up. And then after that, it changes the vote totals or it changes the way votes are recorded. So it's easy to construct software that would always pass the test but then could be used to corrupt the election afterwards.
What one safeguard we've got against that kind of tampering is that the people who write the software don't know who's going to be on the ballot or in what order they're going to appear. Our ballots are not designed until August 15th or so before a November election. Our software engineers out in Austin, Texas, or Denver, Colorado, have no idea what our ballot is going to look like. And so it would be impossible for them to write a program with a predetermined outcome because they don't even know what the ballot's going to look like.
That's the city registrar for all those of you. There's been a hand back in the back, yes.
I'm more concerned about the national picture. I'm feeling very reassured now about Virginia. But, you know, I'm thinking back to Ohio and Diebold are evil machines. Considering the ownership, this is a question for David. You know, when you've got the ownership of a huge block of voting machines, so clearly for one side, I'd like you to address the possibility of pre-programming in that respect. And also, is it possible if you infect one machine that they can talk to all the others if you have the same type of machines? And my third quick question was, if you know about the Johns Hopkins study, if you could talk about that one as well.
Okay. So I'll try to answer all those quickly. So the first question about Diebold's ownership. So the CEO of Diebold got into I call them Diebold, but their real name is Diebold. But their CEO got into some trouble because he sent out a fundraising letter promising to deliver Ohio's votes for Bush in the 2004 election. Now, that I wouldn't interpret that as saying, oh, that means that the code was tampered with. And I think, but it certainly raises the question of when there's someone as partisan as that as head of one of these voting vendors and as their machines being one of the most widely used voting machines, it certainly raises the doubt. And the fact that there's no paper trail that you can go back to and say it recorded the votes as the voter intended means that certainly lots of people believe, and I think probably incorrectly, that the Ohio election might have been corrupted in 2004. But I don't think there's any concrete evidence that it was. The second question was about I'm forgetting the second question. So it's certainly right. It's certainly a possibility. I don't think that's the biggest concern. So it's a possibility that there's some corrupt programmer in one of these voting vendor companies. The bigger concern I have is just incompetence. And this is one of the things you mentioned the study that Avi Rubin and his students and Dan did at Johns Hopkins University and Rice University of the Diebold source code. And it had lots of security vulnerabilities, but it was also just very low-quality code. They found lots of mistakes in there that are the kinds of mistakes that you wouldn't expect a professional programmer to make. And that kind of incompetence, even if they're not deliberately trying to steal election, well, it can affect the outcome. It can mean that the machines don't work and they don't get the correct result. And the fact, so if someone tampers with the software on one machine, because the cards are moving between the machines, this is one of the things the Princeton video that Ed Felton and his students made shows, is that if you can corrupt the software on one machine because you get through the tamper-proof tape without being noticed and the machine was left where you could access it as an absentee voter or in a building beforehand, once you've got your software on one machine, the way the cards are transferred between machines means that software could end up being installed on other machines without you needing to access those other machines.
Except, of course, the cards are not transferred between machines. Each card goes into a specific machine. It's marked with that machine, both in ink and it's embedded in the software.
When you take the cards out at the end of the election, what happens to them then?
They go into at least in Charlottesville, what we do is we put them into a card reader that just tallies the vote.
Machine, and then the other cards are put into the same card reader.
They are put into the same card reader, but they're not moved from machine to machine, which is what you said.
The software can move from the card, from the compromised machine, through the card reader to the machine that you're reading the votes on, then to the next card that you put in. So for the next election, that software has had a chance to get on all the cards that were read in the same machine.
Except that we erase all the cards before each election.
Let me jump in here with a follow-on question about communication, and that has to do with Wi-Fi, which is wireless sending of data, and modems. And some of these machines are set up so that the results of the machine can be directly communicated to the Central Election Office. And Charlottesville and Albemarle don't do that. I believe Fairfax has done it at some point or other. But I would like to know what all three of you, and that's one of the issues that people have raised about a place that things can be hacked into, because here's data going through cyberspace. What do the three of you think about the use of Wi-Fi and modems and whether it's okay or not okay?
I'm against it.
Okay.
Simple.
Okay. He's against it. For or against?
I'm against it. The only thing that our machines hook into is an electrical outlet so that they work. There's no connection whatsoever to the Internet, but it's been a rumor that's been hard to dispel. There have been a lot of people out there who have been concerned about hacking into machines through the Internet. Not here.
Yeah, I'm against it as well, and it's also one of the provisions of the bill in the Senate and the House is to disallow any wireless communication in the voting machines.
Very good. We have all of our panelists agreeing on something. Anne.
I was able to observe the count in the polling place last November in Earlysville. And the reason that what happened then is the reason why I think that having some kind of paper receipt that goes into a box would be very helpful. One of the machines failed about 11 in the morning. And then it was done something too. I wasn't inside for that. And put back online later so that we did have half of the day with three machines and then the whole day with three machines and half of the day with the other one that was substituted in there. However, at the end of the day, that particular machine would not run a consolidation tape. So there was no backup. There was no other information about what really happened there. It was a very close election. There were 10 votes separating the two candidates in Earlysville in the Senate race. Now, obviously, that was all diluted out throughout the state, but it seems to me, just for a very practical matter, and not taking into account any of the possibilities for hacking, if there's a mechanical failure, it seems we have a lot to gain if we have something that the machine spits out, just like an ATM machine, that you look at and then give to your person or put it in a box, and then if you needed to, you could actually see it. It doesn't have to have a number on it that would identify me as voter number 225 or something like that. It would just be able to be in there. So that takes away the possibility of blame is just something we need. And having more confidence in the elections, I think, would make people turn out more, which solves one of Will's problems, because people really and truly figure, what the heck should I bother for? It's not going to count my vote.
Any quick response?
Sure.
The fact that there's not a consolidation tape run in one machine does not mean that there aren't three tapes in that machine that have recorded every single vote that we can take out at the end of the day and see how the voting pattern went, including when the machine was activated, when it was used for each single thing. Now, in order to protect
you that don't know what a consolidation tape is, it's a device that you can use if you've got five machines. Each machine produces a results tape. A consolidation tape allows you to go along from machine to machine, and when you've got to the fifth machine, it will do the adding and produce a tape that shows the results of all five together, so that we humans with our inaccuracies don't have to do the addition ourselves. Now,
but any machine without a consolidation tape, that the tapes are still run out of that machine, and they are added into the statement of results at the end of the day. So they're not ignored.
You don't have to listen to a preponderance of evidence. This seems to be the only credit system in America, especially in Virginia. Seems that's no problem. So I'll just quote Hargrove, the delegate, and say, get over it. But I will not say that. I think evidence is quite too contrary. And it does seem to me that you made some very interesting points. I'm glad we got two views here, because both views seem to be rational enough to make some common sense. And I think we cannot dismiss these two distinct views that we have heard. Now, it seems that we have not said anything about complicity and about preemption and about conspiracy. Now, all of this can go on even before things start in the voting poll. And I think that you mentioned we got to have accountability, and accountability, you're saying, versus privacy. So since we don't have any privacy in other areas of our lives, why do we need any privacy in this area? So what we may need to do is say transparency, public transparency, and all to go with that, and accountability. And that would perhaps solve much of this problem.
That it would. Anybody want to comment?
No, I'm not.
Okay, yes.
I'd be interested in hearing from the election officials and volunteers who are familiar with this. Why should we not wholeheartedly get behind the system that our man described as a thoughtful bill presently in the Senate?
You mean which one? The one to make all machines optical scan, or the one to...
I see on paper what I have voted. I sign it, and it's then put into a roll.
Please don't sign it. We don't want you to sign it. That's a good question, and along with that question, I'll ask you to address the cost issue to change to all optical scan machines.
I think in Charlottesville, Sherry has the exact numbers. I think it's about $200,000.
Yeah, Jim asked to go to optical scan machines.
Right.
So what that would mean, I'll tell you very quickly, that in the bill that everybody's been referencing in the Senate Bill 840, is requiring all of the localities that have gone to DRE to get rid of their DRE and go specifically to an optical scan where everybody would have that piece of paper so we would get rid of our Eastlings. The state cost for that, according to the State Board of Elections, would be about $30 million to do that. Remember, the Help America Vote Act infused money into the localities that had mechanical levers and that had punch cards. So Charlottesville and Albemarle got a significant amount of money, which helped us pay for our DREs because of this federal legislation, which was funded. The state bill, SB 840, is not completely funded. The way they're going to do it is is that the Senator Devilites Davis is going to put an amendment for $10 million. Now, this is a $30 million thing. And the way that the localities would be able to get the money is the state has a hierarchy. The state has a chart that says, oh, localities that are ability to pay. So Charlottesville and Albemarle have an ability to pay, whereas other localities don't. So we would be shortchanged the amount of money we would need to go and completely change the optical scans. There are better ways. And I'm not saying that I'm against VVPAT, the paper trail. I am not. I'm against it because right now there are still too many logistical problems that haven't been answered. We've got a large contingency of blind voters in the city of Charlottesville who can vote a secret ballot on our machines right now for the first time in their entire life. And if we moved, and if we required the paper trail in its current form, which I'm not against, then someone would need to assist them again, and it would not be a secret ballot. So I'm not against it. I just wanted to say that. But it's an expensive proposition.
Sherry's very passionate about this. And it, for the cost question alone, not to mention other aspects of SB 840, I oppose that legislation. There's another bill that Senator Ward Armstrong has proposed, and I don't know what its status is, which I think is far more acceptable. His bill says that whenever a jurisdiction replaces its voting equipment, it has to replace it with an optical scan system. So, for instance, if in Charlottesville our Hart E-Slate ran its course in 5, 10, or 15 years, and we were replacing the entire system, at that point we would be required to use an optical scan system. But I don't like the idea of just wholesale getting rid of all the equipment that we've bought at the cost of millions of dollars over the past 2, 3, 4 years and replacing it with something else that may have its own problems.
Anecdotal stories from Florida in the year 2000 would indicate that there may have been more failures on optical scan machines than there were on punch card machines, number one. I'll throw that out there. In terms of cost, the city just recited what it would cost in the city to do that. They have 8 precincts. We have 29. So multiply that out a little bit more. And the other question that I have, and David may be able to answer this, but he's already talked to us about how you can run the logic and accuracy tests and not necessarily pick up that the software has been monkeyed with and is, in fact, after a write-in vote, going to change the way it's recording things. So why can't one of these computer scientists figure out a way that your paper trail pops up, shows the way that you think you voted, and records it differently? So is that really solving the problem? I think that we're going to have to get a lot deeper into all of the complications and potential possibilities of what might happen before we spend that amount of money. I'm certainly in favor of studying every single process, machine, human processes, and trying to make them as good as we can. And there's no doubt in my mind that we can improve. There have been a couple of people here who have indicated that we talked about having perfect machines. I don't think Rick nor I ever used that term, and I certainly wouldn't, because they're not perfect. But I think that when we get into discussing the rest of the nation, both of us are probably pretty high on the incompetent list to discuss that, because we don't know their processes and procedures and the people that they use. But and I can't even speak to other jurisdictions around the Commonwealth of Virginia. I can only tell you, and Rick can only tell you, what we've experienced personally.
What I can say is that Charlottesville is on the record that when it comes to the point that we want to test the paper trail prototype for the Hart E-Slate, we want to be the test site, and we'll be very happy to do that.
Could you tamper with the software on the optical scan machine and make it record something different? Absolutely you could, just the same way you could tamper with the software on the DRE. The difference is with optical scan, you have a bit of paper that the voter looked at and agreed reflected their vote correctly that you can go back to. And that's why the SB 840 bill has provisions for doing random audits, comparing the paper record with what the machines record, and has a way to do recounts by going back to the paper ballots. There is a report from the committee. I'm not sure if it's available, but I can It probably is available on the Virginia legislature website. I don't have the address for that now. On the question of blind voters, there is a way for blind voters to vote unassisted with optical scan machines as well, and there's a provision in the SB 840 bill for that. They use a ballot marking device similar to the current DREs to mark the ballot, and then it goes through the optical scan machine. So there's still that opportunity for blind voters to vote without assistance.
Okay. Tomorrow, the Senate, or Monday, I'm sorry, I'm off on my days. On Monday, Senate P&E subcommittee will be meeting. The Senate Privileges and Elections Committee will be meeting. They're doing a demonstration. They're going to have the device you're referring to, the AutoMark device. They're having a couple of DRE systems available and an optical scan available for the members of the Senate P&E committee to look at, and then they are taking up during that subcommittee SB 840. So Jean Marie's bill will be looked at in subcommittee Monday. So if people are wanting to see these things, look at it. I mean, it's you can go up there to the Senate.
One interesting sidelight of what was just being talked about, in terms of a voter-verified paper trail or an optical scan machine, is we think of those as being things that we would need to use in recounts, right? But in Virginia, in 2005, even though the Code of Virginia said that the judges who run a recount may mandate that optical scan ballots be refed, our judges refused to do that, except in three localities. And in Sarasota, in the current situation down there, the judges have also refused to look at what is available in terms of a paper trail. So to some degree, the judges are getting in the way, I think. And one of the bills in the General Assembly now basically mandates that in a recount situation, paper ballots would be refed into the machines. Okay, we've got time for one more question. Yes.
David started out with the fact that the opinion that most of us trust computers to help fly our airplanes or to help more medical procedures. But I'm wondering why some of us don't trust, why some of us think there will be fraud. Why is there that fear that, and we don't think that somebody's going to go into the Boeing plant and mess with computer coding, but we're pretty sure that there's going to be voting fraud. Why is that?
I think we have a pretty long tradition in this country of having voter fraud. There's lots of motivation to steal elections and lots of historical accounts of this happening.
There are some recent cases right here in Virginia. I think just a couple weeks ago, the mayor of Gate City was sent to prison for committing electoral fraud there. It was all paper ballots.
Yeah. I long history of airplane crashes, but I don't think that proves anything either.
I think the panel, no one on the panel suggested that there is any verifiable case of machines having been tampered with and votes changed. I don't think anyone has said that that has happened. What has been said is that the possibility certainly exists for that to happen.
And there are allegations that it has happened, but I don't think that there's been any proof possible of it yet. In Florida case, we may find that there was.
Okay. Well, I thank everyone for coming, and I particularly would like to thank our three panelists, Will Harvey, David Evans, and Rick Sincere. And don't forget to leave a couple dollars in the basket on your way out so we can pay for the